Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you doing, man?
Good.
So we're in 99 again.
We're again in 99. Talking
what's going on
again
with
about JavaScript.
Yes.
Yes, this seems to be the center of, you know, JavaScript at Microsoft here, the research guys. You know, we talked about... with Ben,
JS Meter.
JS Meter, that was the thing.
Yep.
And now today we talk about Spur, which is a new JavaScript JIT, tracing JIT that, you know, our colleagues here at MSR have cooked up.
Excellent.
So why don't you guys introduce yourself?
Yeah, hello, Charles. Hello, Eric. I'm Wolfram Schulte. I run the research and software engineering, or called RISE team. And we are doing lots of fun stuff, from understanding software development, using empirical methods, to programming language design and implementation. Spur is a great example for it. But we also do a lot of code analysis. And we have, for example, PEX, developed by Nikolai, by my colleague. And we also build foundations, so we have one of the fastest theorem provers in the world. So we'll try to improve software development for Microsoft and the rest of
the code contracts also comes from your team?
Ah, yes, wonderful. We have Manuel here as well, and he can probably shortly talk about code contracts as
well. Excellent.
Good.
Hello, my name is Nikolai Tillmann, and you might have heard of me before in the context of PEX. That is the other project I'm working on. There the idea is that we take a program, look at different traces at runtime to figure out all the things that can go wrong, whether we can deviate from a path. Now in the Spur project, what we will talk about today is a similar idea of collecting traces at runtime, but then instead of trying to make the program crash or fail, we try to figure out whether there's some redundancy in the trace, and then we can just eliminate it so that the program runs faster.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm Herman Winter, and I'm sort of the compiler guy right here, and the language nut. So JavaScript has been brought into Microsoft, and I'm still at it after many years.
My name is Manuel Fandrich, and I've been working on a code contract project that Eric mentioned, which means providing users the ability to write specifications in their .NET programs, and then tools that take advantage of these specifications, so you can runtime check them, you can statically verify them.
Excellent.
And you can generate documentation.
And that was a very popular topic on Channel 9. And, of course, one of your colleagues, Pele, has been doing a lot of great content on C9. You can dig deep into everything we just talked about, except for Spur.
Yes.
So what's going on here?
Yeah, hello. As I said, I run the programming language design and implementation group as well. And one of the interesting questions is, can we actually take the idea of a tracing JIT and use it not only for building a JavaScript engine or like TraceMonkey or an engine for Lua, but can we actually use it for a general purpose language? And so in this case, we wanted to pick the common intermediate language from Microsoft that in some sense all the languages compile into, and then see whether if we build one generic tracing JIT, whether many applications and languages would profit from it. And in particular, can we deal with dynamic languages like JavaScript? Do we have to build a special tracing JIT, or can we build a general purpose one? And that was the question that we had, and we have some good findings that we want to talk about.
Good. So it's interesting that you say it's like, you know, you want to write a general purpose JIT. I would guess maybe we should be a little bit more precise about that. So you're saying you're taking a common language runtime that's not optimized especially for dynamic languages in particular. In fact, it's very much optimized for statically typed languages. You're writing an implementation of a dynamic language on top of that, and then via the tracing JIT, you hope that you can remove all the costs of interpretation and this extra layer of indirection, and that you implement this dynamic language on top of the static language. Is that what you're trying to do?
Eric, I think you've hit the nail with a hammer. So that's exactly what we try to do. So in traditional tracing JITs, you have special high-level operations that then you compile specially, whereas we compile JavaScript just into MSIL or CIL, the Common Intermediate Language, That's the same language as we compile F-sharp or VB. But then due to the fact that we have, so that means that for JavaScript, for example, we implement the runtime library also just in C-sharp, so not even in JavaScript. And now what we really want to see is whether if we compile JavaScript into MSIL and we have the compiled runtimes, whether we can actually trace through it together so that, for example, the addition operation that's highly overloaded, that has, I think, 9 different paths depending on the arguments, whether we can specialize it at runtime so that we really do integer addition if there are 2 integer arguments and that we don't have to go through all the different code paths to figure out what kind of argument.
Yes, or the dollar operator in jQuery that seems to be the kind of, you know, an interpreter, you know, inside an interpreter that, you know, has all kind of magic. So, and so when you're talking about this tracing and you're saying the runtime library, what does that entail? Do you kind of even take it as far as the whole browser and the DOM and everything?
We're trying to do an experiment where we want to, in some sense, trace between different languages, since we all compile it to one, it shouldn't be so difficult. And for the scenario for tracing JIT for JavaScript, it would be wonderful if you can actually trace into the DOM, because we know that currently there's a big mismatch because the DOM is typically written in a different language and not well connected to a JavaScript engine like in V8. Since we are here on the same runtime, having the same object representation, we think that we can do very well for those scenarios, but we haven't built it yet. So currently we just focus on getting JavaScript work well with the JavaScript runtime and haven't extended to the whole browser. Yeah.
And so before we dive into the actual JIT and tracing, I would like to talk a little bit more about the kind of actual JavaScript implementation, like how you're compiling that to IL and how do you represent JavaScript objects, because the object model for JavaScript is very different than the C-sharp or the IL object model with prototypes and expandos and so on. So can you guys explain us a little bit how that works, how you... You know, how do you compile?
Everybody's
pointing to Herman, who's been doing this for decades.
So we started with the Java, the JScript.net implementation, which was done right at the beginning of the CLR. There was a JavaScript.
I remember that very well,
for .net, and you were the program manager on the other side. So remember that, and the basic compiler is very simple. It just compiles the text into an AST, and then it basically walks the AST, and if you see an operation such as plus, it pretty much only does, okay, generate code to put the left operand on the stack, generate code to put the right operand on the stack, and call a helper routine called plus. And this is all the compiler does. And then at runtime, when you get to this helper routine, it starts looking at the operand, the first operand, and say, well, are you an integer? In that case, go there. And then look at the second one. Are you an integer? In that case, we can do an integer add. Otherwise, we have to do some conversions, and lots and lots of complexity ensues. So most of the complexity actually happens at runtime, and the compiler is quite straightforward.
And so now you're talking about how you represent, say, you know, arithmetic operations, but what about the object model? So if you have a JavaScript object, how is that represented?
Yes, so JavaScript objects are different from the CLR.
Yes.
From CLR objects. In the CLR, the type of an object is fixed. When you create an object, it gets a type, and then that type stays its type forever. In JavaScript, you can also think of objects as having a type, where the type is basically a description that says, given an object of this type, you will have properties foo and bar, and nothing else. And then JavaScript, if you have an object of that type, you can always go and
add
something else, and you can go even delete properties. So then whenever that happens, it's effectively the type has changed. So we represent objects with as CLR objects, so they have normal CLR type, and so the type here is JavaScript object.
Okay.
But then there's a second field, which is the actual type of the object, and this is a field that is mutable, it can be updated. So when the object changes its shape, then we just put a new type object in there. And so we use this when we are looking up properties of objects. So instead of every object being essentially a hash table, what you do is you go to the object, say, what is your current type? And then you go to the type and say, okay, well, I need to know where in this object is there a property called foo. Maybe there isn't such a one, or there is such a one, and then the property will tell you where to find the value of this thing in the object itself.
And so one of the kind of, you know, peculiarities of JavaScript is that you can have both named properties and, well, the names can be integers too, so, you know, arrays and objects are not any different. Do you do anything special there, or do you treat everything just as a, you know, with your type, or do you implement arrays specially?
Yeah, so arrays are interesting because they do complicate things quite a bit. So objects in general can have properties that are just called anything you like, including, yep, including integers. You can get to them with expressions or square brackets notation. And so people use the use such objects as hash tables and as sparse arrays. But so if an object is actually an array, then we try to optimize for the case where the object is actually fairly small and the indices are densely allocated. So in the object, we allocate an actual .NET array. And then we, whenever you access a property of the array, we first know, this thing is an array, and so maybe it's going to be in this dense part of the array. And then we go there first, and it gets kind of complicated because if the property is not there, then it may live on the prototype. And
yes, and also what about like array indexing? So if you represent this as a .NET array in JavaScript, if you go over the bounds, it will just add a new element to the array.
So you have to grow these arrays, and that means that basically, you allocate a bit more space than you really need, but if you run out of that, then you have to allocate a new array, you have to copy everything there. And if you start just accessing elements at random, like your first write is, say, index 0, and your next write is index 10,000, the next one at 100,000, then if you're going to keep allocating entries from 0 to 100,000 and filling them all in, that's very expensive, whereas you only really have three elements. So the array also has to cope with being a sparse array. And so the actual representation of objects and array objects in JavaScript gets very, very complicated. And every time you access a property, you go through all of these very complicated rules about, well, am I dealing with this situation or am I dealing with that situation? And you end up executing a lot of instructions at runtime, which makes JavaScript so much slower on .NET than say, C# is. And so if you have your own runtime for JavaScript that specializes in JavaScript, you can optimize a lot of these things much better. But if you just need to use the generic facilities, life is a lot harder.
But so you paint a nice kind of, you know, a simple picture of like, you know, how you compile this to kind of, you know, naive code, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but I think you must probably do some kind of static analysis to kind of, you know, avoid the most gross inefficiencies.
Yes. So if you want to run it all fast, you have to, as far as possible, try to leverage the .NET JIT to produce good code for you. So in JavaScript, you can reason about local variables, mm-hmm. Provided you don't have funny things in a function like an eval statement or sometimes a with statement or so on. But for most for most functions, you can actually reason about what goes in local variables, so you know all the assignments to them. So you see that, well, I only ever assign integers to this variable, and all the operations I do maintain things as integers. Then in the IL, we actually emit a real integer local variable.
But so how do you know that? Because in JavaScript, there is no integer type, right? The numbers are kind of, you know, if you talk to Douglas Crockford, he would say that's the right way to do numbers. On the other hand, if you want to have integers that do modulo whatever, you know, then they're not so good. So how do you...
Yes. So the program is not going to tell you this. There's nothing in the program that says exactly. This is an integer. So you really have to run the program. So we have something called an abstract interpreter that actually executes the program symbolically. And so we track the values of the variables, and we summarize them as ranges of values. So this variable will be any number between this lower bound and that upper bound. And then when you do operations on it, you just create new ranges. And so if at the end of the abstract interpretation of the function, you know that this variable is always between 0 and 10,000, then you can say, it's an integer. And this happens a lot for things like if you have for loops, say for I from 0 to 100, this picks it up. So typical JavaScript compilers such as V8 have special case code where they look for things like for loops and then they figure this out too. But we have a much more general approach where we actually execute the program in a very general way so we can discover many other variables that are not that do not fit the simple pattern, that they too are integers or doubles.
And so another thing, when you talked about the way you represent types by, you know, what fields are in the object, and do you use your abstract interpreter too to find out, you know, to have more efficient allocation, you know, that you know within this method I'm going to kind of, you know, add these fields so I don't have to kind of, you know, create three types and do that all at once?
Great idea, Eric. And no, we don't do that yet, but that is definitely on our radar screen, and we will. Just after this taping session here, we're going to a meeting to discuss just that.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, you see, I'm clear.
Clairvoyant. So let's jump into the tracing stuff.
Yes.
Because we learned a lot about that.
So this is kind of interesting, because on the one hand you're doing like some you know, abstract interpretation where you're, you know, you're running your program like before runtime, you know, with some abstract values to figure something out. And let's now go to the tracing one where you're kind of trying to do everything as late as possible. So it's like, you know, a very kind of extreme spread where you're trying to stretch the execution of the program, you know, as far away in time as possible. So what is this whole tracing thing? You know, you said like you want to kind of, you know, look at your traces not to find that something goes wrong, but if there's any redundancies.
Yeah.
Maybe you could figure out the funny program in the background and explain tracing in this context.
Let's take a look at this.
That program.
Okay.
So here's a JavaScript program.
It looks like C#.
Yeah, it has some similar keywords, but let's see whether the operations really do what you think they are doing.
Okay.
So what does it do? There's a loop that seems pretty straightforward. And then for a particular index, it does something different. Otherwise, it's adding up a sum. So that looks like we're accumulating numbers here. But then at some point, when I is 990, it goes in here, and then it's concatenating a string, probably.
Yes.
So
990, hello world.
But then the poem keeps going. And it, I mean, we haven't reached 1,000 yet, right?
There's sure.
There are 10 or so numbers missing. And then it comes across this sum statement again. So what will that do? Any ideas?
I guess it will then append one to the string.
It will append one. So it's actually the character one, right?
Yes.
First it becomes a string, and then we append it at the end. So it's the final output will be 990, hello world, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1.
Very useful.
Really? Yeah. And people probably do that.
Yeah, well, maybe not intentionally, but they do, yeah.
Okay.
So we could either also change C# to support this kind of semantics, or maybe not. Okay. So everyone probably understands now that we have a problem here compiling this in an efficient way, because this plus operator has so many different possibilities. And even with our abstract interpretation engine that tries to execute the program symbolically, there isn't really much we can figure out here, because it really can mean different things.
So here's one question. So if you do the abstract interpretation, is that like precise enough to understand that, you know, if I is below 990, that it's an integer, and
no.
Or is it just like, you know, once it goes into this case, you don't know anything?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Here loses everything.
Interesting.
But so the good news is that with tracing, we can actually do something pretty clever here. So the idea of tracing is that we sample a frequently executed path through the program. And clearly, the most frequent path here is in the very beginning where we add up numbers. So for 990 times, we will add up a number here. So what our Spur engine will do, it creates an initial code version where we don't know anything about the type here. And then once this loop gets executed a lot, we will go into a special monitoring mode where we will record a trace. So we have another code version where we can collect a trace while the program is executing. And we will collect a trace here through the common path where it's a number that we add. And so while this looks like a simple statement, Herman explains that, in fact, the JavaScript compiler will translate it into a call to a library function that's written in C#. So when we trace, we will go into this library function. There in the function, it will look at the left side type and the type of the right-hand side, and then it will call the right subroutine to do the actual addition. So we trace through all of that code into method calls, virtual method calls, out of virtual method calls, and then we have this entire information for the loop body. And everything is inlined, and then we create yet another code version for exactly this case. So the specialized code version will have all the operations inlined. There still needs to be a check somewhere that the type is indeed an integer, mm-hmm. because we know that it will change. So there's this check in there, but it's the same check that gets executed over and over. So we can, in fact, pull it out of the loop so that we don't need to do it all the time, but only once. Or when we go into the other paths, and we will detect we have to do something else in there. Yeah, so we have different code versions.
So can we talk a little bit more about that? So when, because you said you have like three phases, but when do you, you said if I run this code for a long time, but in this case, how many iterations of the loop would that be? Because, if you go, suppose at like 989 you decide, this is hot. That might not be such a good choice.
So you can configure that. It kind of depends on your machine load, how much you want to trace. In our current implementation, we trace fairly soon, basically. Then you go around the loop maybe 10 times.
Okay, good. So that was the kind of order of magnitude I wanted to hear.
You can tweak that. But then something else will happen later on. So even when we traced everything and generated optimized code where everything is inlined, so we will keep monitoring where we leave the trace. So there's always going to be a point when your loop terminates where you leave the trace, right? Otherwise, the loop would never finish.
Yep.
And so we monitor which of these exit points happens a lot. And if there is such a point that is really, really common, then we would collect another trace for that point and then create, again, specialized code that now takes into account both cases.
But so here, it's like fusing DNA of the traces, kind of.
Yeah. So internally we call that trace trees. So there's a tree of behaviors that is collected over time. But here, really, the only frequent case is the addition. So we will just ignore the other cases where we leave the trace.
Interesting. And so here's an interesting thing. Suppose this loop wouldn't go to 1,000, but say, goes to 2,000, and so kind of halfway through you kind of switch from integer arithmetic to string. Would you then kind of in that second phase specialize for string addition after you've gone through that loop?
And when you go to 2,000, now it seems like the concatenation will be another just as frequent operation.
Yes.
Then we will have two cases. We generate code that's optimized for just these two cases. Still, everything is inline. We will inline the string concatenation. We will inline the addition case. So it's going to be pretty.
And then at some point, you switch from executing one trace to the other.
Yeah. So if there are truly two cases in the loop, then basically in our optimized code, there will be an if statement here that takes into account both cases. And we have to leave this if statement right here. And we cannot move it out of the loop entirely, but all of these other checks are gone. It's just this one if that's left.
Okay. So and another thing that, like, you know, here. If you here you're looking at loops to kind of find, you know, traces and points where you kind of, you know, re-enter where you were, but there's many other ways you can kind of create loops. Like what happens if you have recursion, or even worse when you're using some kind of self-application where you're defining a fixed point operator where, you know, you might not recognize whether you're kind of have a repetition. How do you deal with those things?
So it really does work best for loops, but we do something for those other cases as well. We basically try to trace...
Now, of course, nobody uses crazy recursion like that, right?
You never know.
Yeah, well, unless you're me, but...
So we basically try to trace through every piece of the loop, of the code, every straight line piece of code. So when the loop is over, we will have another, what we call a trace anchor, that will start tracing from here, and then first we would try to look whether this is hot. But so after every loop there's a point where we basically look for hotness, and then when it is hot, when it does get executed a lot, we will collect another trace. And something similar happens at the beginning of recursive functions, so that we will actually trace into the nested recursive calls, so that all of this redundant checking that happens in JavaScript a lot, getting the right properties out of the objects and so on, that's all going to be inlined and much faster. But still, with recursion, you have some overhead because we actually need to construct nested stack frames, which is something that you don't need to do with loops.
Yes, so that is another interesting thing that, you know, and of course I really, everybody should read, you know, the Spur paper that's available on the MSR site. I was very fascinated by that, because if you're in a kind of, you know, deeply nested call stack where parts of this thing are traced, or in whichever of the three phases you are, that was mind-blowing. I mean, I had to scrape my brain from the ceiling at home when I was reading that. So can you explain a little bit how you do that?
So even without recursion, we do have a bit of a problem with nested method calls, because they happen all the time. So I don't know if you see that right now on the screen, but take again this innocent plus operator. Okay. It will call one helper function to first figure out what are the types of the arguments. Then it will call another helper function that actually does string concatenation. Mm-hmm. So here we have two method calls. And this little if statement I mentioned, in some sense, it's not directly here, but it's in the nested method call where we do the type lookup. So when this type check later on fails, or when we have to switch from integers to strings, this will happen right in the middle of a method call, even without recursion. And then, so if this is not a frequent pass, then what Spur has to do is to reconstruct all the nested method calls, the stack frames, here into the C# helper functions, and then execution will resume right there somewhere in the middle of a nested function call. And so the program doesn't actually see any of all of this. All the local variables have been put nicely into their locations, and the program just continues from there. Something similar happens when suddenly an exception would be thrown. Then we reconstruct the entire context and then throw the exception right in that stack frame where you would expect it as a programmer. So you don't see any of this.
Okay, so if I'm a VB programmer and I use, you know, exception filters, that would all just work. I get presented with it with the normal call stack.
Yeah.
Wow. Nice. So another question is, like, you're doing this for JavaScript, but, you know, now with C# 4.0 we have dynamic, and in VB we already also had late binding in the past, and then of course we have other dynamic languages running on the CLR. Would this apply to that as well? If you know, would you kind of, you know, just trace away all that overhead?
That's a very good question. At some day in the future, yes, it should work for that just as well. But since you brought this up, something that should be said here. We are not currently running on the normal CLR. This is our own kind of prototype JIT for .NET.
This is a research project.
Yes.
It's totally research.
Okay. Okay. We have to make that clear.
Yeah, of course. It's, it says that, right? You know, today's research is tomorrow's reality. So it's not that tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. Some definition of tomorrow.
Yeah.
So our current prototype doesn't support reflection. But there's no reason in principle why it shouldn't work. We just, in this research project, haven't implemented that part, yeah.
So our investigation makes us confident that if we were to put tracing into the CLR, then things like the dynamic lookups in C-sharp would speed up significantly.
Okay, so then there's another thing that kind of fascinates me here, you know, because I see there's Spur, V8, CLR, smaller is better, you know, so can we zoom into, I mean, my eyes are getting old, I cannot read kind of, you know, the white letters that's there Spurs on the x-axis, but...
Wow. Interesting.
Yes,
so what does
you
that
guys
mean?
look pretty pretty good. Well, when smaller is better there.
That's because... We picked these benchmarks.
but that's the choice that you can make, right, when you when you do benchmarks.
But I encourage everyone to look into our paper where we actually have the SunSpider benchmarks, which we didn't pick.
Yes.
So the results are a bit mixed, bit more mixed there. Here we are doing very good. These are our benchmarks. Hmm. Basically, you take an operation, you put it in a loop, and then we see whether we can optimize it away.
Yes, so can you say in general, like, where does this work well, where it works less well?
So it works extremely well when you have loops and then a setting with a dynamic language such as JavaScript, or a setting where you have lots of virtual calls and dynamic behavior. So
yeah, because a lot of people, let's kind of talk a little bit about it, because a lot of people think that, you know, C-sharp and whatever are statically typed languages, but once you have virtual calls, you actually have a dynamic language, right? Because at compile time, you don't know what you're going to call.
And for clarity, you don't want to hand optimize things away.
Yes.
So often in a loop, you might have something where you call x.y.z, and all of those are virtual properties which cannot be statically inlined and optimized away. So you pay that cost every time. And here we can inline virtual calls and make it fast.
Interesting. But what is the one question I would have for you is tracing is not free. I mean, there's a cost associated with runtime tracing, and if you have a big file that's doing complicated things, how is it that this is, why did you choose tracing? Why would this be a faster model in your mind versus, you know, Eric and I interviewed Lars, I mean, on the whiteboard, and he claimed that if you ever go to intermediate language, you're crazy. So, but talk to me why you chose this path.
So, one thing that our tracing JIT does is that we have actually a very fast JIT that just compiles into native code, into x86. Mm. So that means that you initially don't pay any overhead. It's as fast as...
So that's your first phase?
That's our first phase. And but during that phase, we actually do a little analysis what are potential loops so that we put in enough counters to detect hot loops. But they are just instructions that are executed and that are being monitored whether we find a hot loop. And then only if there is in some sense a certain threshold that we reach to determine that something is a hot loop, then we... have our second version where we actually record the trace then for one iteration. And then we have the third version of the loop where we then really optimize. Mm. So that only, in some sense, pays off if the number of iterations for loops or the traces you really execute often. If you only do it once, then don't generate the optimized code that holds even for a statically compiled language. Mm. So it's really the assumption that it amortizes over usage.
So we only spend our compilation resources on the code that we discover at runtime is actually hot.
Hmm. But you're saying the cost, like the startup cost that you have to pay, is not very high because, you know, your initial kind of phase one JIT is already pretty efficient.
Yeah, so in some senses, unlike a normal JIT or the CLR JIT, which does register allocation, we don't even do register allocation. It's just straightforward code. So in some sense, if code is not executed often, why should you pay the price of having a non-linear algorithm for optimizations?
Actually, we do some register allocation, even in that case, but it is very fast. So the cost of the JIT, for code that doesn't execute very often, so we run over the parse trees, we generate a bytecode, then we run over the bytecode and we generate x86, and then we execute the x86. So you could think if you ran over the parse trees and generate x86 and then ran that, or some people argue that you just immediately put the AST through an interpreter, and that's even faster. The thing is, this is code that doesn't execute very often, and whether you do it at a 1x or a 3x, it really doesn't matter. But the moment that you execute the code again and again in a loop, or if the code is hot, any time that you spend optimizing that, as long as it's not excessive, it's going to pay you back handsomely. So the beauty of this approach is that we only really spend compilation resources on code where it matters.
And so when you talked about your static analysis, your abstract interpretation, when does that happen? Does that happen kind of, in your JScript compiler, JavaScript compiler, where you kind of compile to IL? Or, if we're thinking about like JavaScript, its kind of natural home is inside the browser, and there it would happen when you load the page.
Yes, so we do that analysis when we compile to IL, but maybe it bears noting that we only compile to IL when we need to. We do not even compile anything to IL until the method is actually executed. And at that point, we do this abstract interpretation, which is actually very quick.
So in some sense, there's like a minus one phase, depending on where you start counting at zero or one, with the three phases that we saw before.
Yes, so you think of this being the abstract interpretation as being another phase, yes. But that is very, very quick. So if when we measure that, it really doesn't show up much in the measurements.
Just for the higher level, for the people watching this who aren't Eric Meyer's, friends necessarily,
everybody on Channel 9 is my friend.
Well, Charles, I mean, your colleagues, right? Your fellow, language geeks. But I want to ask, so you're saying that with your approach, because if we look at this behind you, that's the architecture, yes?
Yeah.
Okay, so, there's a lot going on there.
Manuel, why don't you lead people through the architecture?
Yes.
That might be good to
have. Let's take it from the beginning again. So the three phases that Nikolai described before were only the phases that happen once you already have CIL, that is intermediate code. Mm-hmm. So the phases that you guys just raised are actually before you even get there, right? So if you start with JScript, as Herman described, you first compile that into CIL in this phase, and that's as Herman said, this only happens just before you actually want to run that code, and that's where the abstract interpretation happens. And once you have the IL, that's when we do the simple JIT, which is the first level JIT, which just straight line translation, block level register allocation only, and profiling counters. That's what goes in there.
Okay.
And you can start running that really fast. And it actually performs really well, too. So if we compare just that code against, say, running the JScript interpreter, which has been optimized quite heavily, it's still already faster than that. It's also, so I think that's correct, right?
Yeah, much faster.
Yeah.
It's on maybe half as fast or up to three times as slow than the normal CLR JIT.
Right, if you ran that IL directly on the CLR, CLR is faster.
Okay.
Much faster.
Mm-hmm.
So
but that's an optimizing JIT.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so then, as you discover that the code is hot, right, we emit yet another version of the code, which we call the tracing code, which now, essentially think of it as the same x86 you emitted before, except that after each instruction, after each sequence of instructions that corresponds to a high-level CIL instruction,
we have sort of a callback into the trace recorder and say, hey, here we just executed this instruction, recorded for us. And then we go on, execute the actual behavior, and then again call back and say, hey, we just executed this other instruction. So that's how we gather this trace here of instructions at the IL level, not at the x86 level, but at the IL. And then once we've gathered the whole trace and determined that it's worth optimizing it, that's when we spend actually all sort of the bulk of the cost of this whole approach is actually in this chunk here. That's where we spend all our time. Optimize a trace.
Okay, so that is quite interesting, because when you know, I read other descriptions of the tracing, people say, oh, when you do the tracing, now you just have a straight line piece of code, so the it's easy to kind of optimize and compile that. And you're saying that that's kind of, you know...
Well, part is because we actually haven't focused on making this fast, because we just wanted to try to produce as good code as we can and without worrying too much about how long this takes. In fact, our measurements don't include this cost, right? Which is another reason why we look good. But if you, so if you... I mean, we say that in the paper, so we're honest. But that's, if you wanted to make this work on, say, your real browser that you run every day, of course you have to now worry about how much time is this taking, when is it worth doing it, and when is it not worth doing it.
But so another reason why this tracing compiler, optimizing compiler, takes a bit longer than other optimizing trace compilers is because we also do some new optimizations in there, which are not implemented with the linear algorithm yet, but so they're new, and we describe it in the paper. So we do some speculation. So even though maybe there are some checks in the trace that, well, technically speaking, we cannot completely eliminate it, but by making one check a bit stronger, we can actually then eliminate another one. And only if later...
So I feel here there's your background in theorem provers and diverse kind of, you know, here. putting to work.
So in fact, that's one of the things we are currently working on, to actually integrate our theorem prover, these three, into this picture. Right now, all the optimizations are done by basically pattern matching and just very local reasoning, but we want to use our theorem prover for that too.
That sounds cool. So you have like, you know, a theorem prover inside your JIT to help you optimize your and reason about, you know, your traces.
Yeah, that's correct. The reason is that in the past, a lot of the people in compilation have developed specialized frameworks, but they're all doing something like alias analysis, or they have to worry about, in some sense, arithmetic reasoning, what happens in case of overflows. And the good news is we built some theorem prover earlier. That's really, really fast. And we can, in some sense, generalize all the analysis that happens currently at the optimization time in the framework of this theorem prover. And then we'll maybe have another interview whether that's actually a worthwhile idea.
I find it fascinating because I've always, like, if you look at a normal type checker, that's like, you know, like a poor man's theorem prover too, right? So I've for many years I've been dreaming about having a theorem prover instead of a type checker, and then as the theorem prover gets better, my type checker gets better. And, you know, I get it for free. I mean,
nice.
Because these guys do all the hard work.
So we have actually had a lot of success by changing lots of our code analysis by using this theorem prover. And now coming back to a tracing JIT, it sounds ridiculous to actually use a theorem prover at runtime for optimizing traces. But as other people are also suggesting, you can actually have the optimization just on a separate thread.
Yes.
And when it ever comes comes back with the optimal code, we simply swap it in, because the whole idea of a trace-based JIT is that you have several versions of the code and you can always jump between one or the other. So in some sense, even if it takes a little bit longer, as long as it comes back and gives us the right result, we can swap it in and we should be
fine. And it's not that crazy, because if you look at the bytecode verifier, that's a theorem prover too, right? It tries to, you know, check certain conditions about your code. So it's not, you know, I think it's very smart. If you have something that powerful, why don't you use it? It's like,
background theorem proving.
Yes. And so are you using the theorem prover too in your abstract interpreter?
No, the abstract interpreter is a very fast, very specialized piece of code. And we do that, we run that over all the code, whereas with the trace optimizer, that's only for the piece of code where we know it's going to make a big difference. So we can, also where we can do that offline. With the abstract interpreter, we have to do that before we can run anything.
And so here's a crazy question, and I don't know, maybe I'm really kind of crazy here, but like the tracing JIT compiler and the JIT, that's all code as well. Do you kind of recursively apply that? Is this like all written in IL as well, such that it can optimize itself? And maybe your team prover then will just trace away all the overhead, and it will be super fast. I mean, this is just kind of the small talk self, kind of,
Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out, Eric. I think you're right on target, but it's sometimes also an engineering challenge to make that all work
there. Yes.
But again, I would suggest that let's come back in half a year, and we can tell you whether it worked or not. So the good news is this... tracing JIT is completely written in C sharp, so there is no.
Wow.
We didn't go to C or something else because we use another piece from research. That's the Bartok compiler, and so in some sense, our tracing JIT is first compiled with the Bartok compiler, and then it runs the JavaScript. Then it runs the JavaScript interpreter and then generates additional x86 code for the JavaScript code or whatever is actually whatever piece of code we want to trace into.
Excellent. For people following along on Channel 9, that's the same compiler used for the Singularity project.
Exactly.
Back in the day,
yes.
Have to find those guys again. I know they're still here.
So one person, I think maybe we can point to Manuel, is there?
Manuel? Yeah, man, give more airtime for Manuel. What's going on?
The Singularity?
Yeah.
Well,
there's a random change in subject.
But it was one of the most popular research videos on Channel
9. Yeah. I mean, I never even approached the amount of views.
Slash dotted, and everyone was freaking out.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of wound down here in research. There was little follow-up work on trying to get Singularity working on multiple heterogeneous cores, like on your network card and things like that. But after that, it just kind of really wound down.
Interesting. Well, it was a cool project. I just brought that up because you mentioned Bartok.
Yeah.
And, we had posted that video as, hey, Microsoft or Mary Jo Foley or the Microsoft Rights operating system is C#. It wasn't quite C#. Close.
But isn't it even cooler that we now write like JITs in C#? And
this is incredible. Let me ask you one quick question, because it's, I know we have to go. But
what a pity.
Background compilation, multi-threaded. So everybody knows JavaScript is single-threaded, but you guys don't have that problem. So you mentioned briefly that you could do a theorem prover asynchronously or in the background.
Yeah.
What are you guys doing today to take advantage of many-core? Everyone's running multiple cores today. I don't have less than two on any of my machines. My phone is 1.6 gigahertz, but it's not a multi-core yet. What are you guys doing today with this engine?
To the best of my knowledge, I have to ask my colleagues, we don't do anything. But what do we plan to do in the future?
Yes, what do we do tomorrow?
That's
what
true.
What are we doing tomorrow? So here is a funny observation. So in automatic parallelization, you have to do actually two things. You have to, on the one hand, make sure that there's enough work that you can parallelize something. And you have to make sure that whatever you parallelize is actually safe. So,
and also you have to make sure that you don't generate too much work.
Yes, yes. So if you look at, and maybe we should take that to a separate discussion, but maybe this is a teaser. So if you look into a tracing JIT, then you recognize that that you can actually say exactly whether it's worthwhile to parallelize, because you have the perfect information at runtime. You know how big your arrays are, or often you iterate in the loop, whether you have dependencies on I/O and something like that. So what you don't have is the information whether it's safe to parallelize. But then there are tricks to using some kind of analysis at compile time as well as at runtime to deal with that as well. And I leave those results for some future discussions.
Excellent.
Yes. So to conclude, I think that you've kind of hit like a gold mine here for future research. It's like you find a new petri dish where you can grow new experiments. I'm really fascinated. It's kind of fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to many subsequent interviews where we can find more discoveries of beauty. All caused by trying to do a tracing JIT for IL.
Yep.
Really
thank
excellent
much
idea. Well, hey, thank you guys.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Sure. Great to actually see you guys on film. I mean, some of you have been on film before. Thank you.